So probably interview number 41, just generally, right? If that's accurate. Paul Rodell, once more, IBS Oral History Project. It is July 25th in the evening, and Otto Friesen,
Friesen.
Friesen, and I have just come back from IHOP, the International House of Pancakes, and we're sitting in his apartment in the Ballston area
Right, Boston.
of Arlington. Otto was in Vietnam in the city of Hue from 1966 into 1967, working in a mobile science project. And I think you're the first person that I've talked to who was in that. Although I did speak to a Vietnamese woman who had some experience with that. Nguyen Thi Quan Hoa. Okay.
I don't know her.
Yeah, she had been involved in the creation of one of these, and I forget in what part of the country. I think further south than way. Anyway, I explained to Otto before turning on the tape about the first question, and I'll repeat it now for the sake of the tape, and then I can repeat it and pretty much shut up, except to, chirp in from time to time and, catch up on things that might have been overlooked or things that occurred to me. First question being about your own background, when and where you were born, what your parents did for a living and for activities, and how they raised the young Otto and any of your other siblings, and the influences that created you as a person leading up to the point where you could become interested in this IVS thing. And now I will just leave you to tell me.
Right. Okay. I was born, let's see, October 31st, 1942, in a city called Elbing, now Polish. My parents, grandparents, and their grandparents are Mennonites, who originally came from Holland and lived in the Vistula Delta as farmers on my mother's side. And on my father's side, my grandmother was a businesswoman, also Mennonite. And my father and mother ran a bakery beginning about 1938 or so. I have an older brother who's 4 years older and two sisters. One is 1 year older and the other one's 3 years older than I am.
This is the town of Elba?
Elbing.
Elbing.
Elbing. Elbing.
And
Elbing.
where is that?
It's near Danzig.
Okay.
It's in the Danzig, it's in the Vistula Delta, Danzig, so.
Was it part of the Polish corridor?
Danzig is part of the Polish corridor, but Elbing is not in the Polish corridor.
Oh,
It was, I guess, West Prussia.
Okay.
So, but the Polish border moved a lot
Oh,
from
yeah.
year to year, so.
Yeah, and century to century.
And century to century, and disappeared entirely,
Yeah.
came back.
Right.
Anyway, so it's now Poland.
Yeah.
So my father, despite being a Mennonite, was drafted and was in the military on a couple of times and died, was missing in action in 1944. At that time, the Russians were overrunning the Prussian area, and so my family became refugees, as about 2 million other Germans in that area, and we wound up in Danzig, not Danzig, in Denmark, in a refugee camp for some 3.5 years, where we were assisted by volunteer groups, in particular the Mennonites, who were there helping volunteers, helping the refugees, volunteers helping the refugees. Then we were displaced in Germany for about a year, in southern Germany, and through the help of distant relatives in Kansas, we moved to Kansas and lived in Kansas, rural Kansas, for quite a few years, from 1950 till about 1960 for me. So, So I grew up as without a father. It was my mother, my grandmother, and four children who emigrated to Kansas. We moved to a rural Mennonite community. About 400 people, where the entire life of the community was centered around the church. People you went and visited were members of the church. Entertainment was church picnics. It was all very church-centered.
What was the name of the town?
No town. This is rural Kansas, so the name of the Mennonite, the community, was the Mayus Mennonite community, Mayus mm-hmm. Mennonite Church. Place where we lived was an unincorporated hamlet of about 10 families, something like that.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. Brainerd.
Really?
It's about 30 miles east, southeast of Wichita, so uh-huh. central Kansas.
Yeah.
People had immigrated there in the 1880s or so
uh-huh.
and established the Mennonite community.
Yeah.
So that's what where I grew up and went to a two-room grade school
uh-huh.
with, sometimes 10 students, sometimes 20 students, depends upon how many transients were moving in or out. So I spent my benighted youth on working on the farm, hating every minute, I might add.
Really?
I went to church, to high school, a small high school, a country high school.
Mm-hmm.
There were 18 students in my graduating class, so relatively small. And it was a secular high school. Most of the children from the Mennonite community actually went to a parochial high school. And so we actually were a little bit in the nature of pariahs and in the Mennonite community because we didn't fit in entirely.
Mm-hmm.
I went to college at Bethel College, which is a Mennonite school in Newton, Kansas.
Mm-hmm.
All my siblings went to school there as well. It was for me actually a homecoming experience because I felt at home at the Bethel College, much more so than the home community in Emmaus or in the high school where we felt I was an outsider too.
More sophisticated in a sense?
No, not more sophisticated. It's just that in high school I was German by background
mm-hmm.
and Mennonite, conscientious objector, and World War II had not been was not completely over in Kansas yet. In 1950 or 55, and so the worst thing you could call somebody in school, worse than calling a motherfucker, was calling them a conchie.
Really?
You'd be sure to have a fight in your hand if you called somebody that. So I never felt very much at home there.
Yeah.
So going to Bethel College was definitely a homecoming experience for me.
Not bad.
Yeah. So at Bethel, I was a major in physics. Relevant to this is that in the summer after my second year, sophomore year, I was a volunteer with the Mennonites at the Wilkwick School for Boys in upstate New York, where there's a school for delinquent boys in New York City.
I've heard of that.
Near Esopus.
That was started back in like the 1870s or 80s, wasn't it?
I'm not actually sure what the start date of it was. I think it was actually a little bit later than that, but I'm not positive. I know that Eleanor Roosevelt was a patron of the school.
Okay.
In fact, it's across the river, Hudson, from the Roosevelt estate.
Mm-hmm.
Somewhere in there. So it may have been, maybe that old. But it was delinquent boys from New York City, and I was there as a camp counselor, which meant that assistant camp counselor actually. That with another young man, we had these boys up to camp away from the school and showed them a good time for a week at a time, different groups of boys.
Yeah.
So that was a good experience. I enjoyed that very much, and it was the first time I'd been away from home for any length of time. Got to see New York City, and so.
This was pre-college?
This was the sophomore year in college, after my sophomore year in college.
Well, you were away from home when you were in college.
No, actually I wasn't. When I started college, actually the year before I started college, my mother became a cook at Bethel College. She worked as a cleaning woman when we were living in Brainerd. I cleaned houses for people, and she was a babysitter for 1 year when I was a junior in high school.
Mm.
And then during my senior year in high school, she was actually in Newton and was a cook and also a house mother of a small dorm. And when I came to Bethel, I had a room in the dorm, and lived at home.
Yeah.
So in fact, I wasn't home at all, away from home at all at that college. So probably not the best idea, but anyway.
This was a real struggle for your mother.
Yes, but we were a church poor, and we lived on charity because the person who paid our way over, because we had no money at all, his shirts on our back, was a married to the cousin of my grandmother, cousin now deceased, so it was distant relative. But they were very kind to us and gave us rent-free, a house to live in. And, we had a cow and we had chickens, we had a garden, grew our own vegetables. Had meat and had chicken, you know, eggs for chickens and chicken, big gardens, so we had a lot of vegetables. So.
Yeah.
So actually we lived, we ate very well, lived well, and had a lot of cast-off clothing, so.
Mm-hmm. Your mom ever remarried?
No. Mm-hmm. No, she had no interest in that.
Well.
So.
I understand.
Yeah. So, I graduated from Bethel in 1964 with a major in physics, and it was 64, so the draft was in place, and a lot of people, including myself, didn't want to go in the military, and going to school was a good way to have a deferment, so there was a lot of interest in graduate school back in those days,
yes.
And I think it was related, frankly. So I went to graduate school.
I'm sure that it was.
And with a deferment, went to Berkeley and was a physics major at studied physics at Berkeley for 2 years. Got a master's degree in physics over there, but actually didn't do terribly well. Didn't like physics all that much. I'd spent a couple of summers at Argonne National Lab in Chicago, and decided I didn't like high energy physics all that much, which is what I was being steered toward by my college mentor. And so I dropped out, was immediately called up for service, and looked around to see where I could do my 2 years of alternative service. Tried the Mennonites with Teachers Abroad program. I really want to go to Africa. I thought Africa would be great. But unfortunately, my religious beliefs weren't up to snuff, and so they said, try something else. And so...
But you're Mennonite.
I'm Mennonite, right. But the... Teachers Abroad program was for teaching, but they wanted people to teach Sunday school as well, and they were afraid of what I would teach in Sunday school.
So you were a little bit too much of a free thinker within the Mennonite community.
Within that Mennonite community, right.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah.
So instead, I signed up with International Voluntary Services, which is actually in part run by the Mennonites as a Mennonite on the board.
On the board, yeah, at least.
But there was no litmus test for religious convictions.
Right.
For the International Voluntary Services. So that was...
Nor any requirement to proselytize.
None at all. That's right, exactly.
Yeah.
Right. So that was in the summer of 1966, actually, August 1966. End of August 1966. Went to orientation at Washington.
Yeah, well, first, how did you hear about it? This was your own research, right?
Yeah, how did I know about International Voluntary Services?
Yeah.
Well, as I mentioned, I have this, let's see, third cousin, I believe it is, who's the grandson. Yes, he's the grandson of the our benefactor who got us over here in the first place.
Okay.
Wasn't in International in IVS in Laos.
Ah, that's right. Yes,
so
you
I knew
mentioned
about
that.
IVS from way back.
Yeah. Okay. So. All right. So this was. It wasn't that you found out about IVS while under the gun from the draft board and went through because I understand that there were lists of alternative service possibilities that were given to people who could qualify.
Right.
So it wasn't that. It was much more personal than that.
It was more personal than that. That's right, exactly.
Yeah. And you said his name, but I forgot.
Oh, Gerald Thierstein.
Okay. Yeah.
Apparently, his grandfather immigrated from Switzerland.
Okay.
So, yeah. So
and
it
was in Laos.
He was in Laos. So that was a an option for me that I was aware of.
Yeah.
And I didn't. I definitely wanted to go abroad at that time, and I didn't want to work in a hospital over here. It's because I didn't realize what all the options were within the U.S., and also I was young and interested in seeing some of the world. But I didn't realize what all the options were available. I thought it was working as an orderly in a hospital, and that was about the only other thing available. I didn't really have a list of possible ways of
Most people always assume that it's bedpan cleaning and things like that.
That's right. You know? Yeah, that's right. So,
I cut you off.
Is there something else you wanted to know as far as the background? Maybe there is something else you'd like to know.
No, that's actually covers it pretty well. I'm looking, trying to look up for your Thiersen?
Thierstein. T-H-E-I-S. T-H-E-I-N, I think. Actually, T-H-I-E, maybe. It's Thierpar, T-H-I-E-R.
You sure he was Laos?
Well, it might have been Vietnam, but I thought it was Laos.
Okay, well, let's check Vietnam. Because I didn't see anything under there.
Right.
V, I went too far. S, went back too far.
This would have been...
Oh, Gerald, yes. There's the Fort Collins address. He was Vietnam.
Oh, he was Vietnam.
Yeah.
So what was the year?
That's on a different
list. Okay, that's all right. That's all right.
Okay.
All right, I see. He was Vietnam. It was long, it was certainly long prior to when I was there. I didn't know that the program in Vietnam was going that long.
Well, I think both countries started at pretty much the same time. He's 58 through 60.
Right.
I think, I don't see any examples on this page, but I think that the first IVS folks, there's one who went in 57 to Vietnam.
Right.
I think that was the first year.
Right.
The contracts with AID were signed sometime in the latter part of 56, and the first mucks to go out there and kind of do the spade work were in the December of 56.
Right.
But anyway, so he was really quite early. He knew.
He was very early on, right?
Yeah. You know, so there was this knowledge in the family that you could tap into.
That's right.
Yeah. Okay. Well, you started to talk about the Harper's Ferry experience, and I've been asking people what sort of training they received either in the United States or then when they arrived, whatever country that they were going to. And I'm curious about what your memory of and impressions of that training experience or lack of.
Well, it was actually, I'd say not training, it was simply orientation. So there was
In
Harper's Ferry and Washington. We had some interviews with AID people in Washington, USAID.
Uh-huh.
And then we had discussions, presentations. I don't actually remember the details at all, except there were a bunch of us there at in Harper's Ferry, and getting acquainted with each other more than anything else, I guess I would say.
I've had people say that it was more the social bonding than anything else.
That's right. I don't remember a thing, actually, what I learned.
Neither does anyone else.
Right. No, I don't.
But then that's kind of true also for some of these early orientations, even if they're trying to tell you something, you're just kind of, just caught up in the thing anyway.
Yeah.
But that was pretty much it for Harper's Ferry. Getting together with the other folks and
learning
who they are and
learning who they are. I'm sure they told us things to do and not to do.
In Laos. A few shots in the arms for all the immunizations.
We did have that. That's exactly. That's right.
So they had to hold you together at some point
for
a few days to expose the arms
and punch
you out a bit.
That's right.
Yeah. So then you make the trip over.
Right. So we just flew from Washington to Anchorage and then stopped in Tokyo. Just very briefly, and then went to Hong Kong, where we stayed 1 or 2 days.
Yeah.
Enjoyed that.
The connections at that time were conducive to really enjoying the trip.
That's right. Well, I was dead when I got through Japan, so I didn't go see the city as some other people did, but in Hong Kong, had a good time for a couple of days. And then on to Saigon.
Yeah, and I want to hear about the training or of whatever you got there, but first, we're on this trip, so you're dead tired when it comes to Tokyo. So that's just a bed.
Completely.
That's just bed. Something maybe to eat, but then Hong Kong is your first real experience.
Right.
What do you remember from Asia in that first cross cultural sort of encounter?
Well, let's see. What I remember from Hong Kong.
Let's see. Remember the incredible greenness of it.
Greenness, okay.
Yeah, it's flying in. It was very incredibly green.
Okay.
We went over to Kowloon.
Uh-huh.
And looked over the border into China.
Oh, you did
China,
that, okay, right? Yeah.
Which was a memory, and seeing how green it was. You know, good joke, right? There's red China, all green. and went through some temples. Uh-huh. A friend of mine, Roy Schroeder, who was joining IBS at the same time, uh-huh. Long-time friend I've known for many years.
He was at Bethel as well?
He was at Bethel as well. He was a fellow science major at Bethel,
oh.
And also a fellow graduate student at Berkeley. I knew him for 6 years.
Mm-hmm.
At that time. Anyway, so he and I wandered around there, and it was quite a good time, actually. We didn't feel particularly intimidated. And,
uh-huh.
I liked seeing what it was like. A good deal of poverty, which was kind of striking, but because it's on such a massive scale.
Uh-huh.
Probably about all I can say about the Hong Kong experiences.
Yeah.
Introduction to Southeast Asia, and I seemed okay, actually.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So it wasn't off-putting in any sense?
No,
was,
not at all.
Yeah. I think back to some of the people who were in my group in Peace Corps, and they wound up in Asia. It's like, ooh, we don't like this. Let's go home, you know?
Right.
So.
Well, there are aspects of Saigon that way. So.
Yeah, well, yeah, I'm sure. How many people were in this group? You mentioned...
I would guess around 30. That's...
was that... Well, 66 is a build-up.
Right. I think it was a big build-up then.
Uh-huh.
There must have been something like 30 people who were at the orientation
uh-huh.
in Harper's Ferry. But there was a lot of splitting up then of people once we got to Tokyo and to Hong Kong. So some people were going to Laos, some people were going to Vietnam, some were going off to language training elsewhere, I've forgotten where it was.
Uh-huh.
So actually, I don't know whether it was just Roy Schroeder and myself who were stopping on Hong Kong for a couple of days before going to Saigon, or whether it was a small group.
Uh-huh.
I just remember spending the time with him touring Hong Kong.
Okay. Yeah. So even the names of the other folks would have just been too vague because you really only had the couple of days and then the travel.
That was Amiato, Tony Amiato or something like that. One name that I
uh-huh.
remember.
Uh-huh.
David Nesmith was in there somewhere.
You mentioned him before, when we were having our pancakes and blintzes.
That's right. I guess, it's kind of hard to dredge up anybody else at this point.
Sure, yeah. That's good. I can't remember hardly a lot of folks too. So, anyway, that's your first kind of baptism, and you're comfortable with it.
It's pretty comfortable, right? Mm-hmm.
It's not off-putting. The culture shock isn't really there. It's curiosity, and saying, well, this is kind of nifty. I'm kind of like looking forward to the experience.
Right.
And then a couple of days, and on to Saigon.
That's right.
And then what?
So Saigon, I spent a very long time in Saigon,
mm-hmm.
about from the beginning of September until this December.
From when to when?
Sometime, like, I don't know what exactly when it was, beginning of September sometime until December.
Really? Okay. All right.
So, and that was mostly in language training.
Okay.
Again, it was, for some reason, Roy Schroeder and myself. We're having language training with a tutor, a young Vietnamese woman who spoke some English,
mm-hmm.
And we spent every day doing language training.
Language and language and language.
That's right. Which was actually, that was kind of fun. I liked doing it, except that I find prolonged speaking wearing.
Yeah.
And particularly trying to speak Vietnamese, and I got ulcers in my back of my throat from...
Really?
Yeah, I was actually felt fairly sick.
Oh, wow.
And it was from the language training, I'm sure. And so anyway, that was day after day. And
mm-hmm.
then I felt less comfortable in Saigon than I did in Hong Kong, partly because of it being a war situation.
Mm-hmm.
And occasionally you could hear bombs exploding at night and that sort of thing.
I went to Vietnam as a conscientious objector opposed to the war, and actually didn't like being in the war situation. And Saigon, you know, if you've been in the third world city, what struck me is a couple of things. One was this mixture of traffic, which was cars, motorcycles, people, ox carts, all mixed together, going
and pedestrians
at, and pedestrians going at high speed down these narrow roads, ciclomayas, motorcycle-driven ciclos, and the also the hand-driven ones. Very dirty, and a lot of places very smelly because of sewer. Sewers running in the ditches. So, not so good. We were and had a compound over there. That is, the IVS had a compound, so we were separated a little bit to it, but it all separated from the city a little bit. But it also meant that we were actually sort of not living with the Vietnamese. We were living separately in this American enclave. I didn't actually care for that at all, that much either.
When you finished up this 3 months, did you try to live with Vietnamese?
Well, no, I didn't actually. Interestingly enough, I guess I describe myself as being xenophobic, and it's actually being in a place, particularly like Vietnam, is a fairly stressful situation for me, and I'll describe some of that maybe a little bit later on.
Well, if you wanted to, you could do that now.
Well, actually, it suits a little bit better later on.
We
had language training, and we were just about finished with language training, or we were finished with language training. It was, like I say, 6 weeks, 8 weeks of language training. But then, for various reasons, my going up to Hue was delayed. And so I spent a lot of time kind of sitting around Saigon waiting to go up there.
Do you know why it was delayed? Was it?
It was technical. I think one of it was there was going to be a meeting of the. So I was in the mobile science unit with the International Voluntary Services there, and there was going to be a meeting of all mobile science people in Saigon.
And so why send you up there? Just bring you back.
Didn't make sense for me to go up there and then come right back.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was some technical reasons like that. I've forgotten exactly the detail, but it was that sort of thing. So I didn't actually get up there until about, I think, the beginning of December. And I say spent some time in Saigon really doing very little, kind of twiddling my thumbs, and I was not doing any more language training at that time. Didn't actually roam around Saigon in a way that I might have roamed around another city, partly because it was very strange and strange in the sense of unfamiliar, but also not feeling very comfortable being out in what struck me as being a war situation.
This brings to mind, because this is a couple times you mentioned that it's a war situation. When you did contact IVS and they said, yes, we would like to send you to this country, Vietnam, how much did you know about Vietnam? And if you knew that there was the fighting going on there?
Yeah, it's interesting, you know. I'm not sure why I went, you know. Mostly I would say it was curiosity and partly to see for myself what it was like. Why I would ever go to a war situation is beyond me. Having, you know, we were, back when we were refugees in Germany, and we were bombed and strafed. And,
yeah, you'd been there, it had been terrifying as
and
a
I
child.
I was 2.5 years old, so I don't remember any of it, but we were in a bomb cellar where all the windows were blown out from bombs, so.
I'm sure if you remember that, you remember an awful lot somewhere in the psyche. And just
right, exactly. So why I went to Vietnam, really, you know, is not unclear. It doesn't make any real sense to me. It's interesting psychologically there.
I don't know, or maybe, you know, just not thinking about it.
Sure,
do I really want to do that country? Even if I like this organization, maybe they've got something in the Middle East or Latin America.
They didn't, actually. I would not have, it was Vietnam or nothing with IBS.
Oh, really? They had closed down all the other programs?
Well, they were closed down, or they had no openings at that time, at least. There was no choice that I knew of, at least with IVS. That if I was going to join IVS, I was going to go to Vietnam.
So they were Okay, yeah, well, and you went.
And it was, I think, in part because I had a master's degree in science, so they were setting up these mobile science units, so it seemed natural for me to use some of my training.
Natural for you and also ideal for them, because they would have had very few, relatively few science people.
That's right, exactly.
Yeah. Yeah, so they weren't going to let you go somewhere else and tell you, well, you could go somewhere else if you want.
That's at least a reasonable explanation for it, right?
Yeah, yeah, okay. Yeah. All right, that occurred to me when I hear this. Like, you know, if you've been a war refugee and bombed once and lost your father, why do you want to do this to yourself?
That's right. That's a good question.
Yeah, well, sometimes I actually ask a couple good ones.
Right.
Doesn't happen too often, so don't expect it, please. But anyway.
All right. So then from Saigon, I went up to Hue, flying by...
Okay, this is still going, but I know that we're getting down very close to the end. I'm sorry, Dave.
Sure, right. Flying with the U.S., Vietnam, CIA Airlines there.
Oh, the Air America.
Air America, right, uh-huh, exactly. Uh-huh. Air America. So in Hue... Because we were out in Hue in the really unpacified area, pacification, you remember being the term in Vietnam,
uh-huh,
rural pacification. And in fact, from Da Nang, we...
Was there, now it's... Sure.
So in northern Vietnam, Da Nang and Hue, the countryside was not safe for Americans.
But you weren't out in the countryside, were you?
No, I wasn't.
Okay.
So the way we got around was flying from Da Nang to Hue.
Mm-hmm.
And so anyway, so I was in Hue with where we had a house for the International Voluntary Service volunteers. Uh-huh. They were 3 or 4 males, depending upon what time of year it was, living in the house.
Uh-huh.
And there were a couple of women who were also there. I was the only one there for science, and the others were there for teaching English, community development. So you asked about whether I lived with the Vietnamese, and the answer is no. I lived with the Americans in this house. David Nesmith, on the other hand, lived with the house for a while, but then he moved out of that and lived actually with the Vietnamese. Which he liked a lot. I simply lived in the house and went to work at the provincial headquarters. Worked with 2 Vietnamese teachers with the aim of setting up science demonstration units. So I don't know if you've had anybody else who was in the in this mobile science program or not. I can
just the one Vietnamese
the
woman.
Okay, right.
And she was kind of vague about it.
Okay,
so
the program was set up.
And actually, I do this.
Sure.
I do have a friend of mine who does that sort of thing now out of Gettysburg College.
I see.
And goes around to high schools.
Right.
And calls himself Dr. Science on Wheels. You know.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Well, I was an advisor only because there were the 2 Vietnamese grade school teachers who were actually doing essentially all of the work. I was there for 2 purposes. One is to give some advice, and the other one is to provide a conduit for supplies. And the way I understood the mobile science program was that we were supposed to to teach the Vietnamese how to do teaching right, which was through demonstration in science, and not via the old French method of rote learning, rote memorization. And so the way we did this was to set up units. Rocks was one of them, for instance, in which we took all of our paraphernalia and made a volcano, baking soda sort of volcano, and rocks for rock tests, rock identification. Went around to the various grade schools where the grade school teachers would be assembled, their school dismissed. And we would show a movie to them, had a portable generator along. We would...
screen on the back of the truck and all that sort of stuff?
That sort of thing, right, exactly.
Yeah.
or screen hauled into the grade school in some cases, with a generator outside. We would give them demonstrations about, you know, how to identify rocks and things with rocks. Or one case it was electricity, so we had magnets and electric motors and so forth.
Yeah, yeah.
All, of course, was to be simple equipment which they could themselves could find or use. And I was there. I didn't actually give any of the demonstrations. That was all done by the grade school, by the Vietnamese teachers, who one of whom spoke English, the other one who didn't. And one of my duties there was actually to teach them English. And so every day I would have an hour or so of English lessons for them, not only for them, but anybody else at the provincial headquarters, educational headquarters, who wanted to have English lessons.
So this is when you guys were not on the road?
When we were not on the road, that's right. So we actually spent most of the time there, like, I don't know, 6 weeks at a time, setting up these demonstrations, and then another 6 weeks or something like that, going around to the schools.
Yeah, yeah.
Even when we went around to the schools, you know, it wasn't necessarily every day, and not necessarily all day either, depending on how far out it was. And sometimes I went along on the demonstration, sometimes I didn't, because they felt the territory they're going to was too dangerous and they didn't want me along.
How come? For your sake or because you would be a target that
both.
Might get them?
Both
of them.
Both for my sake and for their sake. And actually it was an interesting thing, you know, one of the devastating parts of the experience in being in Hue and being in Vietnam was that clearly some of the population was hostile to Americans, and so people would throw rocks at the man. For me, that was psychologically difficult since I sympathized with people who were trying to get the U.S. out, since I was very strongly not only anti-war, but particularly anti-Vietnam War. I felt it was a terrible thing we were doing there. And so it's not good when you're sympathetic with people who are throwing rocks at you. So that was, it was kind of interesting. We had the interesting Vietnamese style of living, which was you go there, work in the morning, take a long time off for lunch, like 2 hours, 3 hours, and go back, work later in the afternoon. So I spent a lot of time reading, getting caught up in my English novels.
Letters Home and all that stuff.
Letters Home, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
So the experience, I felt it was a rather dumb thing to do, frankly, having the mobile science program. I had no sympathy with it, actually, once I was in it for a while, because it makes no sense to be teaching people science teaching methods when they've got better things to think about, like whether they're going to survive the next day, or the teachers whether they're going to get drafted or not, and be killed in the war. Also, of course, I knew that being part of the aid mission, because IVS, of course, had the contract with USAID, that we were there to win the hearts and minds. I didn't like that aspect either. I mean, the teaching was just one part of it. You know, bringing American ways to the Vietnamese, English, teaching them English, teaching them American teaching methods. It just seemed to me as an extension of the U.S. policy there. Part of which was military, part of which was this past, you know, winning the hearts and minds.
How long did it take to come to this decision?
Oh, that realization?
Yeah.
Oh, I was probably 6 months or so, maybe a little bit less.
How did that progress, and what pushed it along? Anything specific?
No, actually, well, nothing specific. It was being in this situation, first of all, of realizing we were couldn't really leave the city or go out far out of the city. We did go to the beach, what was more or less a secure road, although a car was blown up on it. Or a bus on that road from a mine, so it's clearly not a very safe place to travel. So it was very confining that way. There were B-52 bombing attacks outside the city, and so the night was often lit up by bombs blowing up around the neighborhood, so it became pretty clear that we were in a war zone, and I was traveling with U.S. military planes sometimes, sometimes with the CIA airline, so it comes to the same thing. I got rations at the PX. We had PX privileges. I went to the MACV compound and watched movies sometimes. So it was clear to me that I was not separated from the military, even to the extent that I was
I even to the extent of being relying on the military for food and transportation, I guess, at least part of the time. So, so that was for me rather uncomfortable. It certainly went against my scruples as a conscience objector. And
did you try to find some alternatives for the food?
I did. Well, the food, I ate mostly Vietnamese food. I didn't.
Anyway,
I didn't eat too many rations. The PX, and I didn't go to the movies very often.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also a matter of curiosity. I was interested in seeing what the military experience was over there.
All right.
Being on a military base was actually kind of interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And there were things, you know, being in Vietnam was an interesting experience because there are, as I see, people like me who are xenophobic and people who are quite the opposite. Xenophilic maybe. Who really liked living in a foreign environment.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, for instance, interacting with my Vietnamese teacher was often painful because Vietnamese is a very tonal language.
Right.
And so it was fun learning it, learning the tones and all that. But most people don't realize that English is also a very tonal language. And that we put, rather than meaning of words in the intonation, we put in meaning of the sentence. Intention of the speaker. So you can say the same words to somebody and it can be insulting, it can be ironic, it can be all kinds of things depending on what the intonation is.
Mm-hmm.
So English is very tonal.
I've never thought about that, but yes, you're right, because I always think of tonality in terms of like the six different ways of saying the word ma.
Yes, right.
You know, as one example, and
exactly.
Saying that's an example of tonality, that's what makes their language different.
All right.
But you're right. I mean, I can ask a question, I can make a statement, and I can make it ironic, even with the same words.
Right.
And without even changing the word order, or
that
perhaps if I do change it, would be very, very slight.
Well, you can do it without changing word order. So the Vietnamese spoke English, you know, the one Vietnamese spoke English actually fairly well. But tones, whether in Vietnamese or English, are subtle.
Yeah.
And so it was difficult for me not to feel that I was being continually insulted or
mm-hmm.
continually put down
mm-hmm.
Because of the wrong intonation in sentences. And rationally, of course, I knew that it was poor intonation on the part of the Vietnamese speaker.
Mm-hmm.
But emotionally, it was grating, and that's
yeah.
part of my xenophobia that I think, you know, that I have difficulty dealing with foreigners, in part because of that. I was very sensitive to how the words were being said. So that's what I was saying about.
So partially, what I'm hearing you saying in a totality is that you're becoming increasingly frustrated just living.
Yes, right.
I was going to ask you, but before I draw a conclusion, you really obviously didn't like Saigon. Did you like
better? I liked way better. It's an interesting city. You know, it's the old
uh-huh.
imperial capital.
Right.
So I was frustrated by being confined to the city.
Yes. But I'm thinking of the city as
sure.
an urban place. You felt like you could go walk around. There were some interesting things to see, that it wasn't as off-putting as Saigon.
Oh no, it wasn't as off-putting as Saigon, right.
Yeah.
Now, if you don't remember, Hue had two parts, the Vietnamese part and the French part.
Mm-hmm.
We lived in the French area. Which again, I don't know, I didn't try to, say, move into the city, into the imperial city itself, because you know, the walled city is on the other side of the river from where we lived. I think I'm not adventurous enough when it comes to foreign places to actually
mm-hmm.
have done that. Would have had some advantages for me, actually, I think, to have been in there, because I would then have felt a little bit less like an alien in the place, because I certainly felt, because I would have been living with the people. But actually, because I learned, had pretty good Vietnamese lessons in Saigon, I could actually carry on conversation in Vietnamese, and I found that very satisfying.
Mm-hmm.
And I ate in Vietnamese restaurants, you know, the place where you get your chopsticks from the middle, from a bowl in the middle of the table. You know, they're sitting far in a canister, and you wipe them off on the napkin, and you,
mm-hmm. you go to it.
Use the tea to wash your plate, use the tea to wash the dishes if you need to begin with, and then you drink it after, of course, you throw that tea out.
That tea, yeah.
Exactly. Fresh. So I ate that way, and I liked it. I never got very, maybe dysentery once, but other than that, I was not ill.
Just amoebic dysentery. Yeah. So you've been overseas. I mean, some people would say, I got amoebic dysentery.
Right. Yeah. So, but it was difficult. It was difficult for me because of confining, and difficult because I thought the program was silly, and difficult for me because I felt I was acting against my scruples, both about the military specifically, and also about the presence generally. But I also had the contrary part, which is I enjoyed some of the things that you could do there as an American. So because Vietnam, it was a war, the normal
rules...
What
sort of things?
Well, normal rules don't apply in Vietnam. Certainly didn't apply to Americans. So for instance, flying in military planes and sitting in the co-pilot seat on a big plane. So I flew from Saigon to Phu Bai Airport. I don't have a very small airport, but... in a big military plane, you know, co-pilot next to me, there's two of us in the plane. I forgot actually what it was. And, you know, they were coming down in the fog, completely no visibility at all. And, you know, listening to them being talked down, you go left a few feet, go right a few feet, go down a few feet. Mm-hmm. That sort of thing you can't do here, flying in the co-pilot seat.
No.
With Air America and... Pilot asked me, "Can you see way anywhere?" Both of us looking down to see whether we could find the city way. I mean, it's the sort of thing you can't do here.
No, I know. Right? Yeah, yeah.
And the other thing is that normal rules didn't apply to Americans over there. If you were American, you were God. You could do whatever you wanted. If you didn't want to pay for a cab ride, you just didn't pay. You walked away from it. What are you going to do? And a lot of people did that sort of thing. I felt it was a terrible situation to be in. Where normal rules don't apply.
So I was going to suggest two things, but there's actually a lot of things that were waiting on you.
Yes.
The alienness of the culture itself.
Certainly, yeah, right.
The job that you were doing, that you increasingly thought was ridiculous.
Right.
Should IVS be there at all, period.
Right. Sold or sold to the devil, with USAID as far as I was concerned.
Yeah, and then there's... the presence of the military, even if there was no fighting going on.
Right.
And then there's the fact of the fighting going on.
Right.
And that's that, five. You know, and, right. and there could be a couple of nuances right. that I have not
sure.
picked up from you.
No, and the other thing is, of course, there was...
Have I got them all?
No, you haven't got them all, but you've got a number of them. Personal safety.
Okay.
Because during the Chinese New Year in 1967, that was a year before the Tet Offensive.
Right.
I was... in the IVS house by myself for some reason. I don't know where other people had gone to various conferences. Anyway, the way it's celebrated over there is people shooting their rifles in the air. So there was
lots of firecrackers, burning of tires, and all this sort
massive,
of stuff.
Fuselage of bullets. You can see tracer bullets going in the air, bullets hitting the house. I thought we were being invaded. I was terrified. I thought, wait, you know, it was a year earlier, but I thought we were actually being evaded because of all the bullets. You can hear the bullets going over the house. Not good. So I felt personally quite vulnerable and afraid. And so that was certainly another factor for me, being in Vietnam, was personal fear. And I, my friend who was down in Long Xuyen, down in the Delta, who was the only person I really knew well, was far away, and we corresponded once in a while, flew down once to visit him. I think he came up once away. But I actually felt quite lonely in a way as well. I didn't become friends very much with the people who were there, either male or female.
The volunteers?
The volunteers, right. Okay. We were not a close group. We ate together, and it was great. You know, we had wonderful meals because we had a cook. Again, against all my principles, I had a cook. My mother was a house cleaning woman. I didn't think it was a high calling, and to hire somebody to do cooking for you, didn't like it. Anyway, but we had a cook who was very good, and she cooked wonderful Vietnamese meals. So we had dinners together, but other than that, we had almost no contact. Because they were all doing other things, teaching and stuff like that. So anyway, I was also, there's two more factors of personal fear and loneliness was that worked against me over there. So my friend quit, was fired from his position in mobile science. He was also mobile science at Lam Swin.
Quit or was fired? There's a difference.
Well, yes, depends on who you listen to.
Okay.
In any case, it was mutually incompatibility.
Uh-huh.
He didn't get along with his housemates. He's an interesting person, but that's another thing. Anyway, so he didn't get along with him, and they parted ways. And so he flew back to the U.S. Must have been about, I don't know, maybe April, something like that.
Of 67.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
I had about the same time written to my draft board and said I want out.
What do you mean?
I wanted to quit international military services.
Uh-huh.
I had decided by then that it was an untenable situation for me.
Mm-hmm.
And it was about that time. Maybe it was a little bit later. Maybe it was May. I don't remember exactly when. It was about then, though. So I sent the letter off, and let's see. In the meantime, we got some R&R, so I went to Singapore and spent a week in Singapore again with my friend Schrader. That's actually before he. Well, that must have been actually maybe February.
Mm-hmm. So you hadn't been around very long then.
I hadn't been around very long. No, not I hadn't been around way that long. I'd been in Vietnam for half a year, 6 months or so.
Right, but
because I'd spent all that time in Saigon.
You were just really virtually arrived in
probably two or three months. I don't remember the exact time. I didn't keep it.
Yeah.
Sure. So I liked Singapore a lot, and part of course it was out of the war zone. Again, flew with a military plane, but Singapore was actually much more modern than Hong Kong.
Oh yeah.
So.
By 66, yes.
67.
67, definitely.
That's right.
Yeah. Yeah, because I first went to Singapore in 70, and it's amazing, you know.
Right.
You go from anywhere else,
right,
to Singapore. It's just, it really is just like coming back home, except there are Chinese folks.
Right.
Yeah.
And I did the usual thing, you know, buying silk for various people.
Uh huh.
Buying an ivory Ma Young game and so forth.
Yeah.
Which I sent back home. So.
Yeah, yeah.
Anyway, so that was a good time. Then, because I hadn't heard from my draft board, I decided that I had vacation coming from the International Military Services to get a month off. So, again, by military plane, I went to Japan with now a different IVS person, Tim Simpson? Simmers? Tim something.
Uh-huh.
Been a long time. Anyway, we had spent a month in Japan. And Japan for me was like coming home.
It was also?
It felt like, not much more than Singapore. When I went to Japan, I felt like it was, I don't know. I really liked Japan. Didn't speak a word of Japanese.
Uh-huh.
But I stayed in Tokyo with a former college professor of mine.
Oh, okay.
For a week, also Mennonite.
Uh-huh.
And Tim and I spent 3 weeks bumming around Japan,
uh-huh,
going to train, going up north to Hokkaido.
No problems?
Hitchhiking.
Things like that?
No problems at all.
Uh-huh.
Easy to eat because of all the food's shown in plastic. So that was a great time.
Yeah.
That was actually the greatest part of my experience in Vietnam.
Really?
I really enjoyed it.
Yeah.
So then I went back.
I also liked Japan.
Then I went back, and when I got back, I heard from the heard soon from the state draft board, because the local draft board said they didn't have jurisdiction, they couldn't do anything about it, so they sent it to the state, and that's why it had taken so long. It took like 3 months or so.
Okay.
And the state board said I can come back, provided that I find another position to work in the U.S.
Uh-huh.
Find some improved work. So, but in the meantime, I had already told IBS that I wasn't going to continue in the mobile science program before I'd heard from that I was going to go back. Because...
So even if you had stayed the full 2 years you were not going to do the mobile science.
I wasn't going to do mobile science.
Did you have anything in mind?
Yes, I did. And in fact, I started doing it, and that was to work sort of as a vehicle troubleshooter. IVS had, I don't know, eight stations, I don't know, and they all had vehicles, and the vehicles were all having trouble of various kinds. And so, because I have know something about car mechanics, I was started, in fact, to go around looking at the vehicular situation and helping people out with their cars. So that's what I was going to do for the next year, had I stayed. And I liked that much better, actually, even though I just did it for a little while.
They had no problems with that?
Seemed not to. Seemed not to. I mean, I told them this mobile science that was silly. And,
Could be that because they knew that you were a conscientious objector, that they may have, I'm speculating, tell me if you think I'm right, that they may have been more tolerant of you doing that rather than me doing that. Me, they'd say, nah, go on out there and, you know, do that ag extension, Paul, because that's what you signed up for. But if I had been conscientious objector and they would have thought, well, if we do make him leave, then his draft board is going to put him in a uniform, and then we got real troubles.
You have to ask Don Luce about that. I don't know whether there's anything like that or not.
Yeah.
So actually,
it seems almost Machiavellian. It just occurs to me, and I'm not sure. Idle speculation.
Right. It may also be, you know, that that was the time that Stolzfus and Luce were considering resigning. In fact, when they resigned at the same time that I did, actually.
Oh, really?
So
you could have signed on too.
Well, they were. I won't say anything about Don and Gene can speak for themselves about why they resigned, what their motives were. But in any case, they resigned and went back to the States. Probably within a couple of days, maybe a week of what I did. And so maybe that. They'd already been thinking about this and had some sympathy for people who weren't doing terribly well.
Yeah, that's very likely.
So, but that's speculation. So,
but sure. As long as we just sort of opened up the area,
right.
There was discussion about the letter. It wasn't just one person's authorship, and a number of people signed on. Were you one of the signatories?
Frankly, I don't even know whether I signed on or not.
Okay.
I don't remember. You
know. Yeah, yeah. Because Don did tell me that quite a number of people did.
Right.
But I was just thinking that you may not have, simply because you were looking to go anyway.
Right. Well, my motives were different than theirs, because they were nominally, at least, resigning as a war protest or something.
Yes.
And I was not resigning out of war protest. I was resigning for personal reason, one of which was that I found that I couldn't actually be a conscientious objector in Vietnam, because I was with the military, in the military, winning the hearts and minds, and my motives were actually, I thought, quite different. And so I wouldn't be surprised if I didn't sign the letter, just because I felt it was not my reasons.
Okay, yeah.
Because, as far as I know, Gene Stolz, who may have been there as a conscious objector, I think Don Lewis wasn't. And
I don't believe that he was, no. I think, let's see.
I'm pretty sure he wasn't, actually.
So. No, he came out from the Cornell Ag School to do that.
Right.
And he was interested in that.
Right.
And he describes his early ideas as or notions about America's role in that, especially that part of the world, as protecting the people from communism.
Right.
In his early days, and of course, right. He goes through a very dramatic shift.
Right.
But you know, so but if we're talking about his origins, no,
right.
No, they were not your origins
right.
at all.
Right. Okay.
Yeah. So, I might have cut you off. From
no,
something.
I was saying, you know, so they. They left about the same time I did, and for me, actually, the worst moment in Vietnam, one of the worst moments was I was in the airplane at the Thompson Airport in Saigon, and getting ready to leave. We were taxiing out to the end of the runway when they said, oh, they might be having some problem with the engine, mm-hmm. and that they have to turn back. Mm-hmm. And so we actually turned around and started going back to the terminal. That was a great sinking feeling for me.
Oh, really?
Very great sinking feeling. But they decided we'd fly anyway, and I was very happy that they flew, you know, despite any reservations they might have had.
Uh-huh.
And flew from there. This was a civilian plane, so this flew from there to, I think it was the Philippines, actually. And then from there on to Hawaii.
Mm-hmm.
And I spent a week in Hawaii. Spent the whole time sleeping for a week, kind of from mental exhaustion.
Yeah.
I slept all night in the hotel and then found myself a park bench during the day and slept all day in the park bench.
Why couldn't you have slept in the hotel during the day?
Well, because I like to be out to see what Hawaii is about, right?
So, okay, all right, yeah.
So, I was in Waikiki, right?
Yeah. Beach
there, so. I did actually go swimming some too, but I didn't actually go around at all exploring. I booked myself a week there just because I wanted to have some opportunity to recover.
Mm-hmm.
Part of course is a time change, but mainly was I think I was suffering from fairly severe mental fatigue at that time. So mm-hmm. getting out for me was all important. And Hawaii was home. Mm-hmm. So then actually, just to finish that story, is that I flew from there to San Francisco, stayed in San Francisco for a couple of days, looking into a job in San Francisco at the medical school. And the hospitals, actually, I'm putting some feelers in to see whether there are any jobs. Because I had learned by then that one could be a technician in a hospital.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't want to have to be an orderly. Looking for this alternative
yeah.
job.
Mm-hmm.
And then from there, I flew to Denver and mm-hmm. Spent a few days in Denver, where my friend Roy Schroeder had found a position at the medical center in Denver. He had to finish a year and a half. I also applied for a job there and got a job, you know, sort of instantly. It was back in the 67 when jobs were more plentiful than they are now. And so then I went home in Kansas and spent a week or so in Kansas and went back to Denver.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Finished my 2 years in Denver as a research technician. Had a great job in Denver.
Mm-hmm.
That counted as my alternative service. I felt a little guilty. Because I was not only being a technician doing research, which was fun, but I was also getting paid for it.
Uh huh.
Well,
you know, they counted it in Vietnam, getting the head blown off.
Well, potentially, yeah, that might have happened.
I mean, not the civilians much, but the military.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No. I think I know what you meant. So that's really too bad.
What's the too bad part of it?
That the situation was as it was.